But the reality is that there's a certain amount of forgivingness in the entire system. I mean, you know, if you're starting out with an SNRS, well, let's talk EVM because that makes it a better figure. You're talking about an EVM that maybe is less than 1%, 0.9%. By the time you got to the top of the antenna and you got up to, say, 1%, who cares? Because the receivers are still going to work even when you get up to, like, 5 and 10%. So, KQRIWK is rejected.
When it comes to linearity, a kind of digital transmitting is called 16-QAM. In a 16-QAM transmitter, I'd like to have precise amplitude of about 6 different levels in order to fill out that constellation. Does 8VSB have something similar? Are there a discrete number of levels that have to be hit accurately for the system to work correctly? Over to you, Eric, K2LAW.
Now, if you make reference back to that email that I sent you, that had that nice simple paper that you called complicated, and it will see that there's actually 8 different levels. Don't forget, 8VSB is amplitude modulated. It only looks like that flat line when you look at it on a spectrum analyzer because it's a Nyquist filter. So, yeah, you do want to be able to determine the absolute analog level because that's where your information is. But we got a lot of stuff to help us, so we can deal with some variations.
Yeah, simple for one man is not so simple for another, Eric. You've been living with that technology for a decade or more, and I'm being introduced to it, and at first I'm a little bit snowed by it, and maybe I've just got too much leading-edge rejection, and I should modify it. Okay, the next person was David, Kilo Delta 2 Bravo Tango Mike. I think in Plainview. Yeah, he did say Plainview. That was the David of Plainview. Go right ahead, Mike. David. K2RIW in the tech net.
Good evening, gentlemen. How are you? This is David. I got a quick question. Simple for you guys, confusing for me. What I'm trying to do is figure out how I can do N beams toward ARRIs. And originally, I thought I was just going to go with a Signalink sound card, but looking in the MJF or MFJ catalog, I see there's terminal network controllers too. So I'm not sure what I really need to get. Is it a sound card or is it TNC?
I sure hope Eric is with us. KE2EJ, I hope you can approach that one. K2IW in the tech net.
Alright, I wasn't listening too carefully, but I assume you're talking about packet modems, whether you should have one that's in hardware or software.
Why don't you repeat your question, David?
Okay, we'll try it again. I wanted to support in ARRIs using N-beams. I thought I was going with a Signalink sound card as opposed to a TNC, but looking in the MFJ catalog, I've gotten myself confused. Do I need a sound card or do I need a TNC traced with the computer?
You've got it, Eric.
All right, let me explain the difference. The TNC is actually a little hardware box that takes the audio in, and it turns it into either USB that you can plug into your computer and you run a terminal program with it, or in the old days, it would spit out RS-232 and you would go into a serial port of the computer. You can get software where you stick the audio into the sound card, and the software does the demodulation and puts it on the screen for you, and you simply just hook up the audio from your radio to the sound card and you're done, as opposed to having a TNC. I hope that makes some sense to you, and there's advantages and disadvantages to both methods.
Do you have a preferred idea, a preferred method that you would choose, Eric? Go ahead.
That question is starting to get harder to answer because as the years go on, some of the algorithms that people use in the DSPs and the sound cards have gotten better over the years. Whereas that in the TNC, you're talking about hardware filters that are reasonably reasonably now, but don't have the kind of sharpness that you can get out of some really good DSP algorithms, depending upon whether or not you have the bit depth to be able to do it. The typical sound card is a 6 chip, or what we call a sound blaster, which became pretty much the standard. And some of them are only 16 bits wide, some of them are 32 bits wide. Depends on the sound card. They all do essentially the same thing, but some do it with better quality than others, and that depends upon the software that you're using. Does it take advantage of what's there? So, that question's kind of getting hard to answer. I happen to like the hardware box, but there's a certain level of complexity to it. Whereas if you plug in to your sound card, and your sound card blows up, so you just get another one for a couple bucks, so, you know. There's an economic issue there, too.
Yeah, one of the things you should know, David, when I first visited Eric at his home QTH approximately 30 years ago, he was just starting to get very heavy into digital signal processing then, so he's been down that road quite a bit. KD2, Baker Tango Mike, K2RIW, you got it, David.
Thanks, guys. What's confused me is new offerings in the MFJ catalog. They still offer a what looks like a sound card, and still offer a TNC. Then there's the Signalink unit from Tigertronics, and then there's the Rig Blaster, and range anywhere from $89 up to almost $200. So I understand the price differentiation. Are we buying anything when we go at the higher end?
Let me help you with that. Okay, the Rig Blaster, Rig Runners, whatever you want to call them, those usually are basically level interfaces. I mean, they give you isolation from the ground of the radio, which isolates it from going into the sound card and having the ground of the computer and having the two fight with each other. So, it's a good audio interface. Next level up are hardware TNCs, which do specific types of demodulation. They'll do specifically 9600 port packet or 1200 port packet or AMTOR or PACTOR. Whatever it is programmed or designed to do, it specifically does those things. And then there's offerings where you get like the, what used to be called the PK-232, where it's both the hardware TNC and the software TNC, which goes in the computer, so it gives you the isolation into the sound card. It also makes a digital connection either via USB or RS-232. And the reason for that is there are other modes like slow scan and other things that you can get in software, which your TNC is not going to demodulate for you. So there's a variety of things out there. If you have a very specific purpose, the specific purpose is just to receive packet stuff, you can get a cheap packet TNC. If you want to go hardware-wise into a terminal, let's say, which is a good use for a TNC, you only have to go into a dump terminal. You don't need to go into... That's one method, put something in one particular place. You can also do it software-wise. There's a lot of free downloadable software. If you've got a computer with a sound card, all you got to do is plug your audio into it. Or use a Rig Blaster to provide the interface of the audio between that and the computer. Get the idea?
I kind of get the idea. The hardware I was going to use is my laptop running Windows 7, I think. And I was considering the Signatronics Signalink from Tigertronics. Interface that with my HT. Sound like a workable plan?
Yeah, it sounds workable. There's a lot of stuff out there. You've got a lot to choose from. What I would recommend is talk to other people who are currently doing what you're intending to do and ask them what they're using, what they like, and what they like about it, what they don't like about it. And you'll find different people doing different things. You can decide what you want to do. If you want to start now, today, and it's packet that you're after, which I think it is, you could just put software, packet software into Google, and you'll get dozens of programs that you can download and try it out.
Yeah, okay. I didn't want to go with a strictly software solution. I thought I would get at least a hardware box, and I was concerned about that RF ground loop issue that Lance was telling me about the other day.
No, you can eliminate that easily if you're smart about it. There's a lot of ways to do it. One simplest way is you've got a small shack, you've got a computer, and you've got your radio all in the same neighborhood. Get yourself an isolation transformer. Make your own ground system. All the problems that you would normally get disappear.
Okay, I think I'm following you. Thank you so much.
Connie? Go ahead, comment person. Please identify yourself.
Good evening, Dick. This is Mike number 2, K1MJM. I have a Rig Blaster Advantage TNC, and I also use a lot of bionic tiny tracks for balloons and remote operations and stuff like that. And I have an assortment of HTs that I use for this for these applications. And what I found is it's really good to talk to other people, as Eric suggested, really good to talk to other people who do the same thing that you want to do and find out what works, because some things just don't work and some things are very complicated. That's all. K1MJM, back over to you, Dick.
Thank you, Mike. And Dave, you want any thrills on that? Over to you, Dave.
I've started those discussions, and that's how I wound up on the TechNet tonight, to see if there was any other items that I need to be concerned with. I will continue those discussions and then pick an item. So I appreciate your help. KT2BTM.
Let me just throw one more thing out there. What I used to do was to eliminate a lot of my problems. I ran the TNC power supply actually from the same power supply that I ran the radio from, so everything was common.
Mike number 2, MJM. It sounds like you've been down this road, Mike. And you had to go through some of these decisions. What was the choice that you made, Mike? K1MJM, K2LIW?
K1MJM. Dick, most of the stuff I do is the high-altitude balloon stuff and the remote control using packet. I went with the TinyTrack 4 from Bionics, which also has a GPS input, so you can overlay GPS right onto the packet. And I also do it for weather stations and that kind of thing. And radios are a big concern. Some work very well with packet and some don't. Some have little delays built in, some the squelch is slow. There's a bunch of issues you have to watch out for. That's why I recommended going, talking to other people who have tried it already.
Can I answer that?
You got it, Eric.
One thing people forget is that the audio path on the radio is just de-emphasized. And that kills you with packet. That's why you'll see in the modern radio there'll be an actual audio output designed for packet. Other types of services which actually take it from the discriminator, stick it into an amplifier, a wideband amplifier actually, and to bring it up to a reasonable level. So you're just going to take a speaker out, you're asking for trouble.
Comment, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
Dick, I have, Rich just called me, N2EO, and he'd like to help out. He has a lot of information, he said, that might help. But being that he is suspended, I told him this is an open net. I don't think the suspension applies to the net.
It does.
I leave it up to you if you want to pick him up, but he's waiting. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
It does. Don't you transmit, Rich, otherwise you're asking for trouble.
So, Eric, who's on the committees, the various committees of LIMARC, said yes, that suspension holds. So, I'm guessing that suspension is for 1 month. Is that true, Eric? Okay. I think we've gone down the list of everyone who signed in with a question. Their first time to go over to the mailbag. And are they going to stump us this week again, Eric? I mean, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
We have a question. KB2FEL with a comment about the TNC.
Everybody with the science plan is going to be around. All right, the first question, let me later drop, we'll go on to the first question.
Yeah, we had a break-in from FEL. FEL, give us your full call and name and go right ahead with your TNC comment.
Okay, I'm coming in through Echo Link. If the gentleman wants to start a BBS or some type of a mailbox system, I would recommend he run a hardware TNC. I have a hardware TNC, but for other sound card type applications, and if he just wants to connect to other people's BBSs, the signal link will be perfect for introduction into all of the digital modes, and it is a very simple product, perfect product for what you want to do when you're a beginner, and it gives you a good interface, easy controls with the volumes on and off, and it's the simplest way to go. So I would suggest, unless he wants to operate a BBS, he would go with the Tigatronic signal link, and the full call is Kilo Bravo 2 Fox Echo Lima.
Oh, we've got you, Bob. Good signal. Let's see if Steve has any further, Christian David has any further fills required on what you just heard from Bob. BTM, K2IW, go ahead, David.
Thanks, Bob. Talking to a lot of the fellas that are on the ARIES system, supporting shelters, Red Cross, etc., many of them are using the signal link, and that's how I came up with that as a possible solution. I don't know if I need an isolation transformer as part of that. Maybe Eric can comment on that one.
You've got it, Eric. Have you got any further comments?
Yeah, well, the glasses guarantee you won't have issues. But if you're smart about how you power the stuff together and how you hook it together, you actually don't need anything. May get hum or a little bit of computer noise back at you with a direct connection. You could go to Radio Shack and get one of these little $3 audio transformers, which is 8 ohms on one side, that is 600 ohms on the other side. They all have 600 ohms to 600 ohms. You can use that as an isolation transformer. Or you can get yourself a Rig Blaster, or you can hook the stuff up directly, and maybe you get lucky and you won't get any kind of noise. Or if you happen to have a AC isolation transformer and you want to make your own local system, you could do that too, which will cut down on all the crap. But probably the easiest thing is either go get a transformer from Radio Shack or buy a Rig Blaster, which does all the fancy things. It's up to you.
Difference between the Rig Blaster and the Signatronics is about $100. I think I could do an isolation transformer for less than that at Radio Shack.
Yes, you could. I wouldn't just jump out and buy it. I'd actually just take a cable from the back of your radio, plug it in, and see how it works before I go do anything else. You will have to set up a PGT line, of course. The only transmitter to go into transmit.
KB2FEO is additional.
Go right ahead, Bob.
Okay, the Tigatronics method is, it got the keying line, it's got everything, and I've been in Mars for, a little bit over 10 years, and ARIES, and doing much, lots and lots of digital work. I have a TNC running on the Digital Amateur Radio Network here in West Virginia, and all of the new Mars members try the $3 isolation transformer method, and they always have distortion or hum or just things that input from the homebrew network or the homebrew process. And Tigatronics will provide you with the cables designed for your radio, and you can adapt that to any other radio as you go along. So I would strongly recommend the $100 on the Tigatronics, and also the other, like the Rig Blaster and things like that. Folks have had experience with RF in the lines and hum, so Tigatronics looks like the way to go. Or that's my personal opinion. KB2FEO.
I thank you, Paul. Anyone with any further comments on the subject on the table, give me a call. Letters right now. K2IW. Okay.
Yes. What is the difference between disable with two connectors properly done by you, Dick, and the same one done take in front. I don't get it.
Okay. You're going to have to repeat the question because I know you're asking about a piece of cable done by me or done by somebody else. I don't think I understand the question. Go right ahead. Into XJN. I'm looking for his call letters. Haven't heard from him in a little while. Go ahead, Wes.
Into XJN. What is the difference between a piece of cable with two connectors attached to the cable by you and the same cable done by Tigertronics for $100? I don't get it. Into XJN.
Okay, the person who has bought some very expensive cables from time to time is John. In the case of a test cable for a vector network analyzer, there are people who believe that if they buy a very fancy piece of cable with extremely well-installed connectors, and the cable is guaranteed to be phase stable as a function of temperature, aging, bending, and whatever, there are people who want to do that in order to get the maximum performance out of a vector network analyzer. John and I, by comparison, are sometimes a little bit more economical. We realize that the calibration procedure, if done correctly on a VNA, will take out all the bumps and grinds of the cable. So you've done it both ways, I believe, John, both the expensive cable approach and the not-so-expensive cable approach for the test cables of a VNA. And the VNA test cable, to my knowledge, is about the most severe requirement for cable performance. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB, 100% correct. And with the two vector network analyzers, you can use any cable with really basically any connections, and it will do the job. But because it backs it all out in the 12-count program, that's if you do not move that cable, I mean not even an inch, if it's lying still, once it's backed out, it will stay that way. The high-quality cables, which I have paid up to $100 for a 2-meter cable from HP, I mean, it sounds crazy, but there's a cable that you could move slightly, and you would have no change in the setup, so you're absolutely right, Dick.
I can show you a cable that's $2 to put, and another one that's $6 to put, and one won't pass anything past 2 gigs.
You know, guys, there is an application. If I have on the table $80,000 piece of equipment and I afford to pay second-hand money for it, I can spend $200 for the cable. Not a big deal. But if it's a typical application that does not require $100 cable, $200 cable, $1,000 cable, do I ask, what is the difference between the cable done by Dick with two connectors and the cable done by Tigertronics? Not any other company. Tigertronics. What is the difference? I don't see it.
The difference might very well be what you intend to do. If I was doing a very precise alignment and tuning of a relatively broadband circulator, and I've seen somebody who really understands the art and science of tuning a circulator. I've watched that particular guy manufacture these circulators that he used for a space application at Airborne Instruments Laboratory. He could make the circulator on all three ports, at least at the center frequency, have a reflectivity of 40 dB, directivity of 40 dB. It is possible to make a circulator do that. And if you're looking for bumps and grinds more than 40 dB down, you want a $1,800 piece of cable in order to make sure you can really resolve it. We amateurs can tolerate a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, or in the case of some of our no-tuned amplifiers, a 1.5-to-1 standing wave ratio. 1.5-to-1 is something like 15 dB. If you're not looking for 40 dB down, if you're only looking for a 15 dB reflection coefficient, it's hard for me to find any piece of cable that, when carefully used, wouldn't serve that function, as long as all of the strands in that cable are making contact with the outer conductor of that connector at the end. That's an opinion. Let's see if John has seen any evidence saying that that could be true. KC2WGB, the man who's down to his last 4 vector network analyzers and uses them almost every day. Back to you, John. K2RIW.
Comment?
John first, then I'll go over to comment.
good, Dick. Yes, you're absolutely right. As long as the cable is meeting the manufacturer's specs, that the cable's not damaged, it really will work. And whether you're qualified to put on a connector or not, I mean, that's another story. If the connectors are put on correctly and you have a good quality cable, now, I discussed the Radio Shack incident with you and how poor that cable is, but even that cable, once it's compensated with the 12-point program, it works. In all my cases, I've never run into the issue. So you don't have to buy a $1,200 or $1,600 cable. It's nice to have, and you're right. If you're doing that kind of work, you're in that range where that money should mean nothing. So back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, I think that was Mike that wants to make a comment. K1MJM, question mark, K2LAW.
Yep, roger, Dick. It's Mike again, K1MJM. I just wanted to comment. Wesley keeps mentioning Tigertronic cable. They're $20. The cable's $20. It's $100 if you get the rig and the cable together.
Fill in the rest of that comment now, Mike. In other words, the cable itself, a double UHF or a double type N connector on the end of a piece of cable, I think you said is $10 or $20. And that, and if you buy it with the rig, it's either more or less expensive. Or run that by again, Mike.
Yeah, the cable is made to go with the radio. It's really a audio cable. It plugs into the microphone and where the microphone would plug in, remote microphone, and it goes to your TNC, your Tigertronic TNC. The cable by itself is $21. If you buy the whole unit, the signal link with the cable with it, it's around $100.
Oh, it makes sense. Yeah, there is a manufacturer that does it very inexpensively, as long as Chinese didn't touch it. I mean, sometimes they do a good job, but only for expensive stuff. And to see it.
Now, recently there's been a couple of threads of a microwave reflector, because there are a certain small percentage of ham radio operators who think the worst thing in the world that was ever created was a UHF connector. They hate the thing so severely that whenever they see one, they spit on it, they step on it, they damage it with a pair of pliers, they throw it away. They're just positive it's a bad connector. Without a doubt, people have had bad performance on a UHF connector, and I've taken a few of those apart. And my favorite way of putting on a UHF connector is that after you prepare the end of the cable and you're about to screw it into the connector, I tin the braid first all the way around. Then with a good set of pliers, I install the rest of the body of the connector. By doing that, now when you're going to solder through the four holes, you get a very good bond between that braid and the body of the UHF connector. If you didn't pre-tin the braid first, the amount of heat you have to apply to that connector in order for the solder to go inside and soak through all of those strands of the outer braid, that amount of heat for that amount of time is going to be melting your dielectric, it's going to be melting your outer black covering on the connector, it's going to be doing all kinds of nasty things. On top of that, when you've got these loosed up, loose braid strands, let me drop them. When you've got these loose braid strands on the end of that connector while you're screwing it down, it is quite possible to get some of those strands to short circuit to the semiconductor, to get folded back, to make very poor contact, and so on. So there are people who have gotten poor performance out of a UHF connector. It is my belief that in most cases that if the cable has any reasonable quality and they're still getting poor performance, they haven't properly installed the connector. I personally have put 700 watts for 10 solid minutes through a pair of PL259 connectors using the strip line parallel kilowatt amplifier as a source of signal. After 10 minutes and 700 watts at 432 megacycles, the connectors had a very slight warmth to their field, which means they're dissipating a fraction of 1 watt out of 700 watts. That's an insertion loss of 0.01 dB, if you know what I mean. So properly installed, that connector has lots of quality. It's only 1 inch long. I don't care about the fact that it's a 35 ohm input impedance instead of a 50 ohm input impedance. It's only 1 inch long at 432 megacycles with a wavelength in 7 ohms happens to be the best for high power conduction. Yes, the antenna conductor is nice and large, and almost all connectors at our RF frequencies, when you put higher and higher power through them, CW power, the first mode of failure is overheating of the center conductor. The PL259, SO239, has got such a large center conductor. That's the one connector that can safely take a kilowatt and laugh at it as long as it's properly installed. So that connector gives you a lot of bang for the dollars. It's been around for 70 years. There's a good reason for that. But I keep running into people who tell me, what in the world is the matter with you? Don't you know how bad that connector is? And they'll go into a great big tirade and send me emails saying, how in the world can you defend that connector that's so bad? When people have that attitude, their mind is made up. Don't confuse them with facts, if you know what I mean. Anybody have any further comments on connectors before we leave it? K2IRW.
WGB with a comment.
Go ahead, John.
Yeah, Dick, I agree with you. It's a good connector. I've used them up to 1 gig without a problem. Also, when you're connecting with the soldering gun, trying to do that braid, yes, flux, cleanliness, tin the braid. When you make it up, you must use a chisel point soldering iron, not the pencil point, because it dissipates too much heat and you wind up getting cold solder connections, or you leave it on so long, you wind up doing all of the damage that you mentioned. A chisel tip brings that temperature up quick, nice and clean, solder melts, does a perfect job. I have no problem with those connectors. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, that connector is the least expensive, reasonably high in electrical engineering performance, RF performance. I will admit that it's rather poor on outdoor weatherproofing, and if you don't mate the teeth correctly when you're putting together the male and the female, and so that the teeth are not properly seated, you can get a scratchy connection. On top of that, if you're not using the retaining wire, you can sometimes get the vibration that'll loosen the outer nut. So it's got a couple of crazy characteristics, but once you learn to live with those, there's an amazing number of commercial antennas that have a UHF connector in them, commercial high-quality antennas that have a UHF connector input. And it's because that connector is ES4 medium amount of training a person can install it on the cable. It's a real art form to do a real good job of installing a type N connector on the end of the cable. A smaller number of people can properly do that, in my opinion. I think that's part of the reason, dollars as well as the degree of difficulty of putting on connectors, I think it's part of the reason why a good number of commercial antennas have a UHF antenna. Did we get any results from Rich, KTUPS? Has he been giving you any notes, or is it time to go to the mailbag? KC2WGB, K2RW in the TechNet.
No, Dick, Rich has been very quiet. He's probably paying attention to driving and the weather. All right, I think we can go over to the mailbag if it's all right with you. I'll go to my first question. Okay, have a question here from Joe, W2BMP. He's a QRP or Joe, Dick, and he's asking about 40 meters. He backpacks, and he'd like to know what your recommendation for a 40-meter antenna, something that can be collapsed, taken with him on his expeditions, wherever he goes, and be able to work some QRP. So handle that one first, Dick. KC2WGB, back to you.
I may be the wrong person to ask this question, because I do very little HF operating, and I've done in a lifetime an extremely small amount of mobile operation and QRP operation on HF. However, from a microwave point of view, understanding the way the antenna works, when it comes to a field installation of an antenna, if I'm putting up something like a dipole, then I need at least two supports at a relatively high altitude to suspend it at a reasonable number of wavelengths above the ground so I can get a reasonably low angle of radiation out of it. A vertical antenna has a much lower angle of radiation. That's the good news. The bad news, if it's a quarter wave ground plane radial antenna, quarter wave ground plane antenna, it needs a whole bunch of radial wires spread across the ground in order to get good performance. If it's quarter wave, if you're willing to make the radiator a half wavelength long. And it's a half wavelength long electronically. If you don't have that much wire and you don't want to shoot it that high in the tree with your slingshot, let me drop.
Comment at 2MB.
Battery recognized. Once you decide to make a half wave resonator, and if you don't want to use a whole lot of wire because it's a half wave versus a quarter wave, on let's say 80 meters, 132 feet long, you may not want to shoot a slingshot that high in the air, but you can put loading coils on it so that it's electronically a half wave long. But when the antenna is a half wavelength long, the ground plane radios don't have to be much more than a stake in the ground because you're feeding a 1500 ohm impedance instead of a 35 ohm impedance. So as long as your grounding rod has got a relatively low number of grounding ohms compared to 1500, 2000 ohms, if the antenna impedance really is, then you get a beautiful performance out of that. The two people who have done it say that, boy, it's the best antenna they've ever built. And the only thing you've got to add is now an impedance matching network, an inductor and a capacitor, which are rather easy to wind and build, which will step your 50 ohm impedance out of your transmitter up to the 1500 or 2000 ohms at the input of that antenna. It's beyond the range of where your usual antenna tuner can tolerate. So you've got to use this external network. After that, you get a lot of bang for the dollar out of a half-wave radiator, in my opinion. Now, Barry, you've done more HF work than I have, and how would you do QRP, high-performance field work antennas? N2 Moon Mounts, K2RIW in the deck net.
And Dick, after that, put a call out to UPS, because I know he's done a lot of that, and I see he's on Echolink, but we'll let Barry go first.
Roger, Badger, you got it, Barry. Wait for the beeps.
Okay, Dick, yeah, I've also done a lot of backpacking with low-power ham equipment, you know, like an 817, things like that. And I found because everything gets broken in your pack, the easiest thing for me to use, and I've done it and it works great, I just take 100 or 125 feet of wire, I throw it over the branches of the trees until it's as long as I want, and I have a little tiny antenna tuner, which I stick right next to the radio, and I have worked everything with that. And I assume that's what this fellow was doing. He's trying to get out on a low frequency, like 75, 40, something like that, and he's doing it with low power. I've done that, and that worked really good for me. Over.
WS2N.
Okay, let's see what Paul has done along those lines. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I bought the G5RB for the Junior. I use it at home, but I would think nothing of bringing that with me. It's not as big as the regular G5RB. The trick is to get the right one. There's different companies that make them. I bought the Oasis, came out of California, and all the connectors are solid there. Wire is very, very strong. The insulators are very well made. To roll it up, probably unroll it 100 times, and I don't think you'd ever have a problem with that. I think that's good, and then you can get on 40, you know, or below. You know, you can get on 20 or 15. You know, you just can't get on 80. But the other bands, he would be good. You might want to change it eventually and get off of 40, and then he'd have that option. Back to you then.
Very fine, Paul. So you like that G5RV Junior. The one thing I didn't get a clear answer to, Barry, is your 130-foot long piece of wire with your relatively simple antenna tuner. You were able to use that on what bands? 80, 40, 20, and 10? N2 Moon Bounce, K2LIW?
Exactly. I didn't have an exact measurement to the wire, but it can take about 125 feet, and that's all. And you can stick this in your pack. You know, this is an antenna. If it's broken, you just throw it away, and that's cheap. You know, it's just wire. So you stick it in your pack. You stick these little tiny antenna tuners in your pack. They fit in your pocket. I own a few of them. They're so small, and some of them don't even have a meter. They have a light on them, and you kind of make the light get brighter or something like that, you know, to tune it. They're very tiny little things, and they're very, very effective, and I use them on, I've never used 160, but I'm sure I could have. but usually 80 meters, 40 meters. I find when you're out in the woods, and I think that's what this gentleman is doing, if you're out in the woods and you're camping or by a lean-to or something, 75 and 40 seem to be the better bands for that kind of operation. It's been my experience. Over.
Most likely what I'm going to ask you is a little bit too elaborate for backpacking and field operations, but have you ever had a chance to use a helium balloon to suspend your wire up in the air? Over to you, Barry, K2RIW.
Actually, I did that on field day once, and it worked very well. I wanted to keep it. It was very nice. It's expensive, though, because helium ain't cheap, but that's the only drawback.
Yeah, I remember, K2 Young, Eager, and Willing. K2YEW, who's now a silent key, he's done a number of QRP operations, beachfront operations with helium-filled balloons. And boy, he had a lot of fun with that. Let's see if K2UPS is available, because he does a lot of QRP operations from the back of his Jeep. I visited once when he was on top of West Hills, Huntington. That's a 350-foot high hill in the West Hills Park in Huntington. I've watched his operations there. Beautiful operation. K2UPS, if you're with us tonight, go right ahead, Rich. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2UPS, all well, good evening, Dick. No, that's the net. First off, I did use a helium balloon one time, and we thought there wasn't much wind, but there was enough wind to push down at about a 45-degree angle, which was not really optimal, and the static charge was intense, so you got to make sure you have a way of bleeding that off, or you're going to get some nasty shocks. I'm not sure where Joe is planning on hiking, if there's going to be trees around. I do know that he has a KX3, same radio I have, probably has the built-in antenna tuner, which is an awesome combination. If there are trees around, it's very simple to make an NFED wire like I usually, the 31 feet. That works really good on 20 and the other bands, but if he wants to optimize it for 40, he can lengthen it to 53 feet or longer, depending on how much wire he wants to carry. He can also take and make a very simple doublet using just zip cord speaker wire, where it's the transmission line, and then when it gets up to the height you want, you split it and you run it out in two different directions. You want to keep it lightweight, use a guitar pick for the center insulator at the top. You can use dental floss to pull it up. Stuff is damn strong, but it's extremely lightweight. So there's lots of different options. Either a Centerfed doublet or some sort of NFED. LNR, Lee Med Nancy Radio, is a company that makes some very nice NFED antennas designed specifically for backpackers. Extremely lightweight. They make single band models and they make multi band models. So that would be my recommendation, Dick. Back to that.
Boy, that sounds good. This LNR company with these backpack antennas, where they located, that probably doesn't matter. Roughly how many bucks is one of those antennas, Rich? KGUPS, Mobile, probably getting close to Kentucky. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Where do you buy that?
LNR, I believe, is an American company. They advertise all the time in QST, or if you just Google LNR, you should find it. They also make very small backpacking radios. They make one called the Mountain Topper, which is really small and lightweight, not much bigger than an Altoids Mint Tin. CW only, but it's an amazing thing. The whole thing just fits in your shirt pocket. They make a couple other models of QRP backpacking radios also. Some do sideband and CW, so there are different choices there. As far as those NFED antennas, I believe they're probably in the, maybe $70 to $150 range, but that's really just a guess. I haven't purchased them myself. I know people who have them and have been very happy with them, good quality and extremely lightweight, and they do work well. They make individual bands, and they also make one, I think, for like 40, 20, and 10, that supposedly works a little bit better than just a random wire, but I usually just use random wires and had very good luck.
Rich, when you're doing this backpacking, sounds to me like you're definitely, in many cases, running off of battery power. What kind of batteries do you, how many watts of output for how many hours of operation, and what do you do to recharge those batteries? I'm guessing you periodically go back to your vehicle to recharge them if you happen to get into some heavy QSOs. K2UPS, K2LIW.
And if you're backpacking, batteries can get pretty darn heavy.
KV2FEL with a comment.
Yeah, but UPS first. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, and yes, like Barry said, the batteries are a huge concern if you're hiking in. And I know so many guys that get, oh, I'm going to get into hiking, and I want to bring an 857, and I'm going to run 100 watts, and they have no clue what they're getting themselves in for as far as battery requirements to do that. I mean, if they're planning on going out and operating for several hours with a 100-watt radio, you don't want to carry the battery that's going to be required to power that. It's really pointless to run much more than 25 watts on a portable operation because you don't need it. You can lower your power and get much more batteries. But the battery life that I have, the KX3 has 8 internal AA size batteries. Now you can run anything you want in there, but outgoing batteries don't like to be drawn out too quickly, so you're going to have to lower your power to maybe about 3 watts. The charger that's built into the radio is designed for nickel metal hydride chemistry batteries. Now with those in there, the radio will put out 5 watts. It's a little more optimum if you run it down to 3 watts. There's special circuitry that kicks in to extend the batteries even longer. But at 5 watts on the internal batteries running CW, I can get easily 5 hours worth of QRP out of the park or down at the beach. I have several nickel metal hydride external packs that are about the size of a pack of cigarettes, and they're, I think, in the vicinity of 4 amp hour capacity, rated at 12 to 13 volts. And with those packs, the radio will actually put out 10 watts for a few hours. So I usually have several packs with me. I don't need to recharge. Some of my friends have solar panels, and if they go out with full batteries, the solar panel will keep the battery semi-topped off so they're not completely depleting it. But don't expect to go out with an empty battery and a solar panel unless it's a really big panel, and expect it to charge the battery and power your radio at the same time. Back to net.
Your solar panel that you bring with you when you do, roughly what is its area and its power output? Rich, go ahead.
I myself don't have one, but one of the guys, Mike, that I go out with a lot has one. He has several of them, as that, but the neatest one was one that he got at Harbor Freight. It's thin when it's folded up. It's maybe a little over an inch and a half thick. It folds up like a briefcase. It just opens up once like a book. I think it puts out about 13 watts maybe. I could be wrong on that. He had to buy an external solar charge controller in addition to that. So the panel with the controller was probably a little over $100. But it works real well on a sunny day. You could operate, as long as you had light there, you could operate infinitely.
Well, that sounds like fun. Wonder how much of that kind of jazz you've done, Bob. KB2FEL, K2RIW, the TechNet.
QIS, query.
KB2FEL. Yeah, I've been on a couple of what the Maven used to call poor man's de-expeditions to Mung Gap Pond. If 125-foot wire is great, but what I wanted to say was add a counterpoise to that. Another 100-foot of wire, just lay it on the ground, and your performance will increase pretty much. But the straight wire is a great way to go. It's easy to do. You break it, you throw it away. But don't forget about the counterpoise.
If the antenna is an NZ half-wave electronic resonator, then the counterpoise is a hell of a lot less important. Bill, AC2IS, go ahead with your question, K2LIW.
Yeah, AC2IS, I have an unrelated question. If you guys want to finish up with your DX stuff and come back to me, that would be fine.
Okay. We're going to make a special exception for you, Bill. Go right ahead with your question.
talking to Jesse, who asked your first question today. And by the way, I believe today his contact with you on TechNet was his very first ham radio contact. So I'm thinking he did pretty well with that. And he was asking me what he might be able to do as far as a better antenna with his handheld radio. I suggested the diamond mag mount that I had, but I was wondering if you had better suggestions, AC2IS.
Yes, I do. Go ahead and buy a commercial antenna if you want. However, because of the way 2 meters operates, because it is so altitude sensitive, because the signal gets sifted through the trees and gets absorbed by the trees, every bit of altitude makes a huge improvement. If you made a very simple coat hanger wire 2 meter ground plane antenna, that antenna consists of a UHF SO239 connector where the four holes hold four pieces of wire that are four radials, and the center hole holds the actual radiator piece of wire, and you mount that $1 antenna, so to speak, on the chimney of your house or in the roof of the in the attic of your house. You give it some altitude, and you run any old ratty cable you want. RG58 is good enough, and even though RG58 at 2 meters has got a fair number of dB of loss per 100 feet, you run that cable down through the house any way you want to. Put connectors and jumpers anywhere along the line where one jumper would be in the bedroom as the cable goes down to the living room, another jumper, and as it goes over to the kitchen or the dining room, another jumper. And now, no matter where you are in the house, you open up that jumper, connect it to the handy-talkie. Because the handy-talkie through that piece of RG58 cable is now talking to an antenna with some altitude. It will make you 20 decibels and more stronger, as if you have increased your power by 100 to 1 when you do that extra altitude, even through that lossy piece of cable. We're talking about a couple of dollars. Let me drop a couple of dollars worth of hardware that gives the signal you radiate some real altitude. And now with that handy talkie in your hand connected to that piece of RG58 cable, you can walk around the room. There's no difference in signal strength as you walk around the room, sit in the chair, lay on the floor, do whatever you want. So when it comes to the best possible performance for the least number of dollars, what I just described is a significant thing to consider. Yes, you can go out and buy $200 real dual band antennas with some extra gain to them and connect them to the chimney of the house. That's later on. For the time being, that simple antenna connected to your handy-talkie is going to give you a tremendous amount of performance. And if that was Jesse's first QSO on the air, fantastic. He should have told us. That worked out very well. EC2IS, thank you for all that information. K2LAW, go ahead, Bill.
AC2IS, to the best of my knowledge, I think Jesse's in an apartment without roof access. I guess there's a chance he might have access to an attic, but I don't think so. But, you know, if he has access to an attic, maybe he can get something up in there, but he's not going to be able to get anything on a roof. I predicted in my conversation with him that the first thing you would recommend would be altitude. I think Jesse also is working on his own handmade unidirectional coupler. I don't know if Jesse's still listening, but it would be cool if he could get that question in, or if not, he seems interested enough that he'll be tuning in next week and he could ask them. AC2IS.
The house he's in, the apartment he's in, is giving him some attenuation. Even if he has no way of getting extra altitude in that apartment, the antenna sticking out the window outside of the walls of the apartment are going to give you some extra signal strength. Also, no matter where one of the things you'll notice that when you've got a handy talkie in your hand and you walk around your apartment and you're listening to a repeater that's reasonably far away, you'll see peaks and valleys of signal strength as you hold the handy talkie high, low, left, right, tilted horizontal, tilted vertical, tilted away from you, and so on. What I'm getting at is the multipath in every apartment, in every reasonable environment, is such that the there are certain places where you get a null in space by way of this fixed antenna that he can homebrew, that he puts in an appropriate place, as high as possible if he's got extra floors in the apartment or out the window. And so with a little bit of experimenting, he'll find a place where the antenna picks up a strong signal in that multipath environment. And now the antenna being fixed, and he's connected to it with a cable, means he can now walk around without the signal coming in and out during his conversation. So even if he hasn't got extra altitude, choosing the right place to mount the antenna will give him 90% of the benefit. Over to you, Bill, K2RIW.
Yep, sounds good. If the weather were not so cold out, yeah, he might be able to wait to run a wire easily out the window and up the side of a building somehow. Yeah, maybe next week then he could ask his questions about his unidirectional coupler with PC board construction. AC2IS.
When you said unidirectional coupler or a directional coupler, what makes you think that Jesse needs a directional coupler, Bill? Go ahead.
Jesse was interested in testing his antennas. Like you said, he doesn't really have test equipment that will tell him how his antennas are performing. So he's thinking that this directional coupler might be able to get him something like an SWR measurement, which he's thinking of sort of cobbling together gear for also, AC2IS.
If you and I were building a building, Bill, and we're making it out of bricks, I could do a test on each one of the bricks to make sure that gravity is going to pull each individual brick down. I could test each brick like that. Or I could make a leap of faith and say, hey, it looks like a brick. I slap some mortar on it and I put it on the wall of the building that I'm building. By the same token, you find the right article on how to build a coat hanger wire quarter wave ground plane 2 meter antenna on 2 meters out of four pieces of coat hanger wire that are each around 17 inches long for the ground plane radials and another piece that's around 18 inches long for the center radiator. You follow that design. You don't have to test it. It's close enough. You find somebody's design where you just do the calculations of the wavelengths. And because of end effect capacitance, you make it 95% of a quarter wavelength long for each of those pieces of wire. It'll play like a charm. You don't have to test that antenna. EC2IS, K2RIW TechNet, make a leap of faith, Bill.
This is AC2IS. I don't think Jesse was thinking of a directional coupler and testing a 2 meter antenna, but for testing the cloverleaf antenna that you guys were talking about earlier today. He's actually been making some modifications to the design that he's been working with, but he does not really know whether his modified designs work better than the originals or not, and that's what he's trying to figure out. AC2IS.
When you're way up there at 5.8 gigahertz and you're homebrewing test equipment, that guy with a lot of experience can do that. A brand new person, I don't recommend it. Beg, borrow, steal, go to your buddies at your local ham radio club. Somebody owns a network analyzer, but runs at 5.8 gigs. Borrow it, go to his house, do the test. I don't recommend you try to build test equipment that'll give you results that are even slightly traceable to the Bureau at 5.8 gigs. I don't recommend that, Bill. AC2IS, K2RIW.
AC2IS, I don't think I recommended it to him, but he seems very interested in taking that on. I think, though, he would be pretty happy to know of a person that has equipment that he could test his antennas on. If you've got any names you want to mention, I'm sure he'd be glad to hear that. AC2IS.
Every one of the Limark flea markets has a guy named Andy, WA2CDL, who appears there with all kinds of test equipment. And people walk up to him with their handy talkies, with their 2 meter rigs, the 450 rigs, the mobile rigs, the base station rigs.